We were talking about the weather earlier, and I will say, even though it's a little bit disturbing how warm it is, like it is nice to like feel that change in the weather. It's nice to be maybe past the snow. I got to do the God-given right of every Vancouverite, which is I got to take a photo of some crocuses blossoming and send it to my friend in Ottawa, who then sent me a photo of the 3 feet of snow he's still under.
Yeah, I was going to say we do have to be mindful of the fact that we are in an isolated, a thermally isolated corner of the country, and everyone else is still well buried in snow.
I
So
think I
now.
just need to make more friends in other parts of the country because I don't have someone I can like lord our weather over right now.
The most important part of being a Vancouverite.
I mean,
Like,
what
if
do we pay all this rent for
Yeah,
if not
exactly.
that?
Yeah, if you can't send crocus photos to your friends back east, what are you even doing here? Like, what is the point?
Like move literally anywhere else and pay less rent.
Yeah. Well, now that I've alienated the entire East Coast of Canada,
yeah, welcome back everyone to the Trade Waiters. Thank you so much for joining us. Today we're going to do part two of Our Dreams at Dusk, and this is a continuation of our previous episode. If you haven't listened to part one, which covers books one and two, make sure to listen to that one first. We go over a lot of important exposition, and as usual, we will be completely spoiling books three and four in our discussion, but they are well worth the read. I do encourage you to seek them out. So, as usual, I'd like to start with a character building question, but this one I'd like to do something a little bit unusual. So, in the book, they have an organization called Cat Clutter, which all of our characters of Our Dreams at Dusk, they hang out at this resource center, and then together they go throughout the community and take abandoned old houses and structures and renovate them into something new for the community. And this is such a fun way that they give back to the place where they live. And community is something that's really important. And certainly I've heard a lot of discussion about how important it is to get to know your neighbors and how to form community and this and that. And I always found it very intimidating when I thought about it, you know, like, oh my God, get to know my neighbors. That sounds really scary. And I am in a place now where I do actually know the real neighbors who live adjacent to me. But for a long time, I didn't until I realized that your neighbors is just anyone in the same city where you live. And getting to know your neighbors does not have to be that complicated. In fact, this is something that we don't talk about often on the podcast, but this is a podcast that is presented by the Cloudscape Comic Society. And the Cloudscape Comic Society is something that all three of us have been a part of since its very beginning. Jeff, I was wondering if you'd be willing to give the 30-second spiel of what Cloudscape Comics is today.
Oh, sure. Cloudscape Comics is a charitable society in the city of Vancouver that is committed to connecting comic artists in the province of British Columbia. We do weekly meetups and we're trying to foster professional development, skill sharing, and just trying to open up publishing opportunities for people that live in British Columbia and to a lesser extent, Canada in general.
And
Yeah.
how many books have we published?
Oh my goodness. More than I can even count now. Like I think we're at about 20, 25 or so books now that we've published in over 15 years.
How many members do you think we have actively?
Ooh. I mean,
It's in the
that's
hundreds.
yeah, I
More than a
mean,
hundred.
I think our members list is easily over 100, though I think within that we maybe have I'd say like 40 to 50 active members that kind of regularly communicate and check in and do stuff, you know?
And this is a
Yeah.
group through which we've been able to do a lot of great work supporting the artists in our community and to support the community in general. But I wanted to wind it back a little bit. And I don't think we've ever talked about this on the podcast. I wanted to talk. My character building question today is, how did you first come to Cloudscape? And from like a very nuts and bolts, like logistics way of how did this happen from its very inception? And maybe Jeff, probably you're the first one.
Ooh.
Makes sense to start.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Wow, what a question. I mean, it's funny because like Cloudscape really just started on a whim. I was dating someone at the time, actually, and she was like, "We should have a comic collective." And I was like, "What is a comic collective?" And she's like, "It's like any art collective. It's just a bunch of artists that get together and like, they do the same practice. They like support each other." And I was like, "Well, that sounds like a lot of fun." And I set up a Facebook group originally called the Pictorial Storytelling Enthusiast Society. And yeah, I know. I see you shaking your head. It's a bad name, but
It was the early 2000s. Every name for every organization was something like wacky like
I don't know.
that.
I thought it was very funny at the time, but it started as a Facebook group and we had a whole bunch of people join, and then it became very apparent that almost everyone that joined lived in the Vancouver area. And we started meeting regularly at a coffee shop because I was like, well, why be on Facebook? We can just meet in person, which oddly prescient to realize the importance of not being on Facebook and being in person. And we decided on Wednesdays. We used to meet every week at the Grind, or a variety of cafes, and then we eventually settled on the Grind Cafe. I think
Why
originally
did
we
you choose the grind?
chose the Grind because they were the only cafe that wouldn't lock the doors and start hitting us in the ankles with a broom at about 9 p.m.
Yeah,
They were a 24-hour coffee shop.
they had space. They were disinclined to like push us out when we weren't buying enough coffee.
They, unlike other coffee shops, they had a back room, so they had double the space of a regular coffee shop, and their staff was pretty apathetic until around the time that we got our physical studio space, and that's it was well timed because suddenly the owner started working on Wednesday night, and they started coming into the back room with a broom and glaring at us, and so then we knew it was time to move on. So,
So the key was, if I can recap, you had the idea to coordinate around something that you were really passionate about, comics, and you just made a group and found other people who are also passionate about it. You decided to meet in person, you set a time, and you found a place that would have you. And that's all there was to it, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's that simple.
JD, how did you find it?
Well, I think I was there for the very first conversation. Like Jeff and I met in line at a Scott McCloud book signing. And I think that was when you were starting to talk about the idea of like a comics collective, if I remember correctly.
I actually think we had a few meetings because I feel like the
Okay.
concept of Scott McCloud being in town had been like a topic of discussion. But I think we were kind of, I don't know, I don't think we'd really come up with like a formal name, or I don't think we'd even settled on like a consistent like location. So like I think maybe the Facebook group had existed and the Wednesday meetings existed, but basically you were there for everything else that came after that.
I think I was there for the first like in-person meeting, and I remember the part that I brought to the table was the idea of making an anthology because I just had been accepted into my first publication, which was an anthology, and I thought, hey, this is a thing that our collective could do. Like we could all do a short comic, and then put all those short comics together, and we'd have a book. And none of us have done a book before. This could be like a shortcut to getting there.
Told me about flight. That was the first time I learned about flight. It was from
Yeah.
you.
I mean, I wasn't in flight, obviously, but flight was the inspiration for the anthology that I was in. And flight was amazing. And of course, like, why wouldn't we want to do something like that if we could?
Oh, how interesting. Erica Moen just posted a really interesting retrospective of how she got into flight and the inception of flight on her Patreon, I believe publicly.
Ooh,
So that might be
interesting.
something.
Yeah,
An
I think I saw
interesting
some of the
like
photos.
parallel telling. But yeah, like I found out about it because JD, you reached out to me on LiveJournal.
That's right. I was like trying to think of who else I knew in Vancouver that made comics. And it wasn't a very long list at the time, but I knew of your web comic. I can't remember if we'd interacted much online before that.
I feel like we had chatted
Yeah,
because
a
I
little bit.
remember you telling me about this and I remember knowing who you were.
Okay,
But
okay.
okay,
I think it
yeah.
was a similar of like at the time. So I had just graduated university and this was kind of like a time in my life where I was very much in transition and I had this web comic that I started in university and I was like, well, I'm no longer in survival mode of engineering school and I have this thing that people are reading for some reason. I can choose to put more effort into it and just see what happens, or I cannot. And I decided I would put more effort into it. And so I think similarly, I'm like, well, who else is doing web comics in Vancouver? So I remember JD writing to me about this meetup that was happening. And at the time, I was unemployed. I was interested in comics. And I was like, sure, why not? So I just like rolled up to the grind, being like, what up? How's it going? And I remember at the time I knew nothing about independent comics. I knew nothing about indie comics or like the scene, if there even was a scene. I had come in through like the anime fandom kind of side of things, which was very different and very separate at the time. I feel like it's less separate now, but at the time they felt very distinct.
Yeah.
So yeah, like it just started very simply with like an idea, Facebook group. Email on now defunct services and now defunct cafes, but it was not the point I wanted to make for the podcast is that it was not very complicated in the beginning, and we did not have any of these lofty goals.
Yeah.
Despite this, it has grown into something really beautiful.
Yeah, and like the whole time that I was reading Our Dreams at Dusk, I was thinking of the comparison between Cat Clutter and Cloudscape. It's like, yeah, this is really familiar, this idea of like a bunch of people get together and they have a little society and like they become each other's support network and they actually like go out into the community and accomplish things. Like not like world changing things maybe, but people changing things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
even though that organization was not the focus of these next two chapters, it was kind of part of the background structure. And I thought it was really great because, yeah, it reminded me of Cloudscape too. So I just wanted to highlight that. That was my
Oh, thank
character building
you. That's
question.
really cool.
Yeah.
Can I just wanted to also really quickly say to anyone listening, speaking as one of the organizers of Cloudscape, that I would say the other ingredient in what made Cloudscape successful was nobody was like the big shot leader. Like I was organizing things, but like I never felt like I needed sort of to be listened to by everyone and that I needed to sort of be the front and center of attention, you know, like it was putting the community first, you know, like it's like you have to let go of some ego. And I mean, I don't think I was perfect at that at all times in the evolution of Cloudscape, but like I think that part of its longevity is that it sort of exists as its own entity that other people can sort of take leadership roles within. And it's not a very top down hierarchy. And I think that's also an important thing. So if you're starting a group, if your membership starts to pull things in a certain direction, like ride that wave instead of trying to fight it. And you'll probably have your organization last longer than if you're suddenly like, no, you're doing it wrong. It's supposed to be this way. You know, that's my other piece of advice.
Very good. Okay. So yeah, one of the things that we do as our society is we have this podcast where we talk about books. So we are talking about Our Dreams at Dusk, books 3 and 4. And when we last left our heroes, we had started to get to know Tasuku, who is a high schooler who is discovering his identity as a gay kid and having certain conflicting feelings about that, certain conflicts with his peers and his identity and himself, but he stumbles across the resource center, meets many other queer people in his community because it happens to be a place where queer people have come to just hang out and support each other. And we last left off when Tasuku and Misora were going to a festival together, but unfortunately, things did not end well between Tasuku and Misora, and there was a big fight, and the fight happened to break out in front of Tasuku's crush, Toma. And that's where Volume 2 ended. And we pick up a few months later, and they're back at school. So this was a big deal for Tasuku. He was discovered for being gay among his classmates right at the end of the school year, and he basically thought his life was over, and then he kind of came into his own through cat clutter and the resource center, and now he's back at school. And the first kind of plot thread in Volume 3 is the My Shinamami project in high school, where his classmates are directed to go and take photographs of what their town means to them. And it just so happens that through the health club, Toma is there, and they start to talk again. So, should we just pick up there and see where it goes?
Yeah, like I'm glad we're doing books 3 and 4. I feel like these are the books where we find out a lot more about all the characters, because they're also so interesting, so different. Like we didn't spend a lot of time talking about characters in the last episode because most of the juicy stuff is in these books. So yeah, I'm happy we get to talk about some side characters too. But yeah, maybe since we're already talking about Tasuku, let's start with that, because I think he's got a really interesting arc
Yeah,
in these two books
Tasuko
as
and
well.
Toma. Yeah.
Yeah, like that's sort of, I think, a lot of the story is framed around the idea of that this is a possible future romance between Tasuku and Toma. I really like how it plays out, though, that it's not necessarily that. Like Tasuku does confess to Toma that he likes him, and that kind of doesn't go well at first, and then that reveals more information about Toma, and then at the end they become like really close friends, and like maybe someday there'll be more, but that's not really what the story is.
I agree. I think I really liked the framing of this, that through a mutual interest, let's say, they discover things about themselves, but it does not necessarily develop as a relationship between the two, at least a romantic relationship. And I thought that was really refreshing.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's kind of your standard like cliche, right? It's like you have the two characters and like, okay, they got this guy who's a little more out and guy who's kind of closeted and like he'll come to realize and he'll come out and then they'll be together and they'll be happily ever after. And I mean, that is like, I don't know, a like very like fun, like very neat and tidy and enjoyable narrative, but I think that like this felt more real. And I one of the things I really liked about this was at the end when like his last name's Tsubaki, right? It's Toma Tsubaki, because like in the version I have, he's always referred to as Tsubaki, and I wanted to make sure like I'm getting it right.
Yeah, it's
Anyways,
Tsubaki-kun. Yeah.
okay, but yeah,
And Kaname-kun.
but yeah, okay, so I'll stick with Toma. So anyways, but yeah, I just thought it was interesting where like Toma like is talking to Tasukun and like basically saying like I feel like maybe I have some like queerness in me, but I'm not really sure what that means for me. I'm not really sure what I want. Like you seem a lot more confident about yourself and what you want, and so like I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready to be in a relationship right now because I still got to figure stuff out. And I think that's like actually a very mature take for a teenager. But I think that made a lot of sense where it's like he sort of has this revelation where he's like, hey, maybe I'm not 100% straight and I just don't know what to do with that just now. And so I'm going to need some time with this. And I think that was like a really cool reaction, and they're still friends, and it's like they're sort of both helping each other grow still, and I thought that was like a really nice way to present it.
Yeah, I think it ended well, but it was a bit of a journey to get there. Yeah, I think Thomas spent a lot of time being quite a jerk, to be honest. So, like, the second he figured it out, what was going on, the fact that the cat clutter people are an LGBT group and Tasuku hangs out there, he's like, hang on a minute. He starts pushing Tasuku a little bit. He starts teasing him, sort of flirting with him, sort of, but also being like quite antagonistic,
Yeah.
similar in the way to. Similar to the way Misora did as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of slurs. That is a lot of slurs at the beginning there with Toma. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a scene where they go out for this My Shinigami project, and Toma, without telling Tasuku, invites two other girls along. So Tasuku thinks like, oh my God, I get to go with my crush just one on one, and we're gonna do this thing. And then he shows up and like two other random girls are there. And I loved the way they did it in the book where they like crossed out the girl's name because the protagonist is like, I don't even
That
remember who these people were.
and we
Like,
never find out their names.
yeah.
That was really fun. Like, I really like that because I for less interesting reasons than Tasukun, but like I definitely have been to like a social gathering where we go around doing introductions and then like I'm like, I have already forgot everybody's name. I'm gonna have to find a clever way of getting them to say their name a second time. But like, yeah, I enjoy the fact that like it's just like he does not care who these two girls are. It's like their names go in his ear and right back out again, and like it, he just they're completely forgettable characters in this interaction to him, and that's I think how the author treats them in the story too.
However, despite this, there is a moment when they're eating very Onomichi ramen, very special city ramen, and Toma is being a jerk and talking about the cat clutter people in very disparaging ways, and it's actually unnamed girls who unnamed girl-san who stands up for queer people, and Tatsuku felt pushed into a corner. He's like, am I gonna have to stand up and say something? And no, it was this girl who did, instead.
Yeah, that was a fun moment. Just interesting sort of, I mean, interesting character moment for Tasuku, where he's like put on the spot and then like never really finds out how he would respond because he doesn't get the chance. He missed his chance. But then also just world building, where like, yeah, just because there are people who are homophobic doesn't mean everybody's going to be.
Yeah. And so it was another interesting moment of someone feeling unsure of themselves, testing others in a brusque and antagonistic way. So, as I said before, like kind of a foil or complement to what we saw with Misora, but ended in a very different way.
Yeah, it was fun. Like, this is one of the things I like about this series is how complicated all the characters are. Like, a lot of the enjoyment in reading it is trying to figure out what is actually going on with Toma. Like, yeah, I reread these books, like the books 3 and 4, so that we could, I mostly so I could keep track of like, okay, what happened in the first half, what happened in the second half, and not I'm not mixing them up. But even knowing what Toma's arc was, there's still that interest of like figuring out like why is he doing this? What is going on in his head at this moment? Which is also what Tasuku's trying to figure out, but I feel like as a reader, you have the benefit of distance to be able to sit back and think about it. And yeah, it's
Yeah.
interesting, it's complicated, it's very unique. He's like definitely an individual character. I don't think he's meant to be like a trope or like an example of this is a type of person. He's just himself.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think he behaves in a chaotic way because he's having chaotic feelings, you know? Like, that was my read on it, is like, I don't even think Toma knows why Toma's saying what he's saying or doing what he's doing. Like, you know, it's like he kind of likes the attention he's getting. He's kind of flirting and then he's kind of liking it. And then that makes him feel weird. So then he says like a slur because he's got to distance himself from it. It's like, yeah, I don't know. It felt very believable to me.
Yeah, it's almost like kind of I felt it was kind of like a bit of a power trip for him, where he's the one in control of this conversation. He can like dial back the homophobia or dial it up and like he's basically putting Tasuku on the spot to be the one who always has to respond to him rather than the other way around.
Yeah, and I love that it showed a lot of growth for Tasuku as well. Like we mentioned that at the end of the arc, Tama is actually saying to Tasuku, like, hey, you've just seemed so sure of yourself, and I think that's really cool. But we know that that is not where Tasuku started at all. And I was really proud of that character for standing up to Tama, you know, this person who, you know, he's being flirted with, he's being pushed around, he's being antagonized somewhat, and he stands his ground. After the festival, and he's like, listen, what you're doing is hurting me, and I like you, and that's not here or there, but I don't want to see someone I like hurting other people. And I thought that was very brave, brave moment for Tasuku.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was, I mean, that's one of several visual metaphor sections in the comic, which that is something I think, thinking about it more, one of the things I really liked in the series is how they kind of embody that intense emotion as kind of like almost like a dream sequence. It's like the character's still conscious, but it's like rather than just showing how they are reacting in the moment, it's like you get into their head, and it's like he's, you know, he's in a flying saucer, and he's, it's like, or so, there's a whole bunch of different scenes where like his emotions are embodied by these like lavish visual metaphors for like how he's feeling, which I thought was really well done.
Yeah, I also like Tazuku's arc is like a lot of it is also him coming to terms with like because in book two he has this situation where he's trying to basically where he's trying to push Misora to be more out and to sort of figure out his identity. And then that goes really badly. And then the second half of the series he's kind of like put in more situations where it could have gone the same way, but he's learned from his mistakes and he's being more cautious and just sort of accepting that uncertainty is okay. You don't have to know everything about everybody, know what category to put them in. You might not even know for yourself.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think as I was rereading it, what became clear to me is that from my read, there's a really strong theme throughout this work of the difference between understanding and acceptance. And what I think a lot of people in society are demanding is understanding. And what the queer people in this story are asking for is acceptance, where it's like, I don't necessarily need or want you to understand how I feel, what I am. I'm not asking that of you. I'm just asking to exist as I am authentically.
Yeah,
And I think,
that's an interesting way to put it.
yeah, I think it comes up again and again. And so we see that with Tasuku and Toma. He's like, I don't understand how you're feeling, but I don't need to. I accept you as you are today. And as that changes, I will continue to accept you.
Yeah, I think that especially in the second half, I found like there was multiple examples of kind of like microaggressions and then also like people with good intentions who are nevertheless kind of like inflicting pain, whether they're conscious of it or not. And I think a lot about like is it it's Oyama who starts showing up
Yeah.
and like recognizes Utsumi, but then keeps misgendering Utsumi.
Yeah.
And first, I
Oyama
guess,
keeps dead naming Utsumi over and over again because Oyama-san knew Utsumi in high school before he transitioned. And this is another big part of book three. It's another focal point of book three. Utsumi-san is something of an unassuming character, I would say. He's always been there since book one, kind of in the background, but we don't know anything about his deal, and he does not let much on. In fact, like even only through this dead naming and misgendering does Tasuku figure out. He's like, oh, okay. He had not picked up on it until then. But yeah, it's a rough road for Utsumi in this book, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just like the amount of emotional labor Utsumi puts into this friend, quote unquote, friendship until it hits like a point where finally Utsumi's like, yeah, no, like this is, I've had enough of this. And like
Yeah.
Oyama's, I mean, it was so strange because like Oyama was like had this weird rationale where it's like, oh, I wanna support you, but like I wanna support you in this very specific way because I think you speak to this idea I have about transness. And so like you have to live into that or it makes me upset. You know, like she's like in tears at the end, like, no, like you're not like them, you're different somehow. And it was like,
Yeah,
what is
it's
your deal,
like,
lady? Like,
yeah, at a point, Oyama describes transness as like a disorder, which is different from homosexuality, which is a choice. And Utsumi does not respond well to that concept at all, understandably. And Oyama is trying to also like put him up on like a pedestal as like a hero or something, like, please come talk to the children and like tell them about who you are. And he's very clearly like, that is not my deal. That is not who I am. I thought it was really interesting how he described Oyama as not a bad person and himself as not a good person. And to me, what I read in that line is like, I'm not a hero. I'm not someone who's here as like a champion or a representative or an advocate. I'm just a guy who rides a bike. That's all I want to be.
yeah, Oyama is such an interesting character because I feel like, and I don't know, maybe I do this in my own writing too, where you, like if you've got someone who's sort of an antagonist or a villain, or at least at a point in a story, they're the one who's the problem. It's very easy to sort of turn that person into a type. But Oyama is, I don't think, typical of anything in particular. She's just got her own weird hangups, and I think that's a much more likely or common scenario is like a specific person just has a weird hang up. They're convinced that they've got it figured out and they've got it wrong, but they're not going to be talked out of it. And it's like when you have a society where, like, for example, people elect homophobic politicians, it's not necessarily the case that all of those people have the exact same wrong idea. It's like a large collection of very different wrong ideas. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. So actually I'd like both of you to give me your thoughts on Oyama's daughter, Mai-chan, because Mai-chan seems really to enjoy, you know, the time spent at the drop-in center and the time with Cat Clutter. And there's like this whole thing where like they're making tiles, decorative tiles for outside, and like Oyama's like, oh, Mai-chan, you must want to do something pretty like a flower. And like Mai-chan's like, I just want to do a boat. And she's like, what, a boat? A boat's not pretty. Girls want to do flowers, not boats. And there was like kind of this ongoing thing with Mai-chan really enjoying being at the drop-in center and feeling uncomfortable around her mother. And I was like, I feel like maybe she's got her own thing going on, like maybe she's closeted in some way. It wasn't clear, but I was kind of wondering, like, what do you think? Do you think that she's maybe.
So what I read into that is that, first of all, Mai-chan is 5 or something, and
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I should have been
is
more
a
clear about that
little,
at the start.
yeah, but like I think it's important to be like, Mai-chan is 5, and I don't think there's enough to read anything specific into it. I think Mai-chan already knows enough about herself to realize that she has different ideas sometimes, and those ideas are not accepted for one reason or another. But what she has found among the Cat Clutter people are people who are accepting of different ideas, people who are different and understand what it's like to have different ideas and are accepting of that. And to me, I don't feel the need to read any more than that into it. Because I think that's something that I've encountered a lot throughout my own life. It's just like I resonate with people who understand what it means to be different in whatever context that is.
Yeah, I
That's a
think
good way to put it.
that's with I think it's written that way with intent, where we are not meant to necessarily read too much into Mai Chan, because I think that's how one should react to kids. Like you can't say to a kid, I think you might be queer. Like that's not an okay thing to do. You got to let kids figure out their own identity on their own. And I feel like this is part of why Mai Chen is in the story. It's like, here's someone who maybe that's possible, but like that's to be determined down the road. That's not any of our business to sort of figure out right now.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, those are good. Thank you. Those are good takes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and I think the other interesting and important function of this scene, the scenes involving Mai Chen and other children, it's just like the cat clutter people can have a workshop for kids and it's fine. They can look after kids and it's fine. It's okay for kids to encounter people who are different and understand that it's like there's different types of people in the world. And it means a lot for different types of people of all sorts to be accepted when you're young and to see that represented in the society you're living in.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
Yeah, and
that's.
I think that's the other role that Mai Chen plays in the story for sure, is that like that it's not weird for her to hang out with these people. That's normal.
Yeah, at one point she finds out that Haru-chan, Haruko, and Saki are getting married. And so she asks, like, are they both gonna wear dresses? And they're like, yeah, probably. And she's like, oh, okay. I'd like to make them pretty flowers to wear.
Yeah, very, very kid response there, I think.
Was very sweet.
Yeah, I guess in some ways through Mai Chan you kind of just see how Oyama just sort of has her own ideas about everyone and kind of just steamrolls along with everything, right? That it's her daughter just wants to do a boat because she wants to do a boat, and then she still has other ideas like, no, not a boat. You got to do something else because that's not what I would do. I personally wouldn't do a boat, so why would you?
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, it could be that like the reason she's so attached to the cat clutter group is that she recognizes something in herself too. But like, again, like we're not gonna figure that out within the time span of the story.
And we don't need to, for sure.
And we don't need to. We don't need to understand. Just need to accept. And I think Oyama as a character does get there in the end. She kind of recognizes of like, I'm hurting people. And so like good on Oyama-san as a character where she kind of recognizes that she still allows Mai-chan to go and be with the cat clutter people. She uses them as like a babysitting situation sometimes, but she gives them cookies. She gives someone some cookies as like a thank you. But she recognizes like I need to do some thinking and growing, perhaps, which is good, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Speaking of Haruko and Saki, we have their wedding in is it volume 3? No, it's volume 4.
It's volume 4. So like actually we didn't mention something we said that we would touch on is kind of our struggles in getting volume 4. I did want to make sure we had some space to talk about this. And it's interesting because like I got all of these books originally somehow. I thought I had them on my Kindle, but books 3 and 4 are no longer on my Kindle. And then I saw that they were all still nominally available. And usually on the trade waiters, we want to make sure that all the books are available for people to read. But then as we went to try and repurchase them, as I tried to go to repurchase physical copies for my collection, book 4 is hard to get.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I usually get the physical books, and I was able to get the first three books, but then like anywhere I looked online, like book four was either hard to get or impossible to get. Like I could not get a physical copy of book four. I had to go to Kobo because I couldn't get it on Kindle either. And even getting it on Kobo was like weirdly difficult. I'm not even sure I understand exactly what was going wrong at first, but I couldn't get it, and then I could get it. So I do have the digital version
Oh,
now. I have no clue on whether I'll be able to get the physical one ever.
I'm curious what you did because like I have mine on Kobo and I bought volumes 1, 2, and 3, no problem. And I could not purchase volume 4 at all until I went to my PC and I turned on my VPN and I cycled through different countries on the Kobo website. And only when I was in Kobo UK didn't let me buy volume four. So I had to pretend that I was in the United Kingdom to be allowed to buy book four ebook of a four book series, which, like, I don't understand what's going on there. Somebody forgot to sign some kind of a licensing agreement is my best guess.
Yeah, so
Maybe.
I work really hard not to be paranoid, not to ascribe malicious intent. Maybe the reasonable explanation is that this is a very small series from a creator who, despite being very popular and well read in Japan, is not very well read in North America. It takes time for series like this to gain momentum, so it's possible that they didn't see good sales of one, two, and three and chose to print less of book four, making it harder to acquire, and they haven't seen enough demand to reprint it yet. That doesn't explain the digital license issues we're seeing. However, I think it's interesting to note that this is the book of the series that features a gay wedding.
But on the other hand, like I thought about that, but then why would you, if there were someone who were trying to prevent book four from being in the world, why would they not also block the first three books? Because, like, there's not a
Yeah.
huge difference in content between the other books and book
Yeah.
four.
It's
If I'm,
very curious.
yeah, because if I'm somebody who like goes around banning books, I'm gonna get this entire series banned. Don't get any
I
ideas,
th
folks. Don't do that, but
yeah, please don't. But I on the other hand, we have talked to Ryan Estrada a little bit about the types of people who do this. And the types of people who go around looking for books to ban. And if you look at the covers of one, two, and three, they're just people. But book four has a lesbian wedding essentially on the cover. And I don't know. Like I said, it's possible it's just a licensing issue. But I apologize to our listeners that volume four is harder to come by than volumes one through three. I do think it's the strongest volume in the whole series, and I do really recommend doing what you can to get it. I ordered it through my local store and they haven't been able to get it for me yet. So I also ordered a used copy off ThriftBooks to try and get a copy here. And I don't know, this might be a difficult series to complete if you're trying to collect it.
yeah, I think you're right. That was definitely worth getting book four. Figure out a way to get book four. It's worth it.
So let's talk about it. Let's go through book four and the type of things that are in it. Do we want to start with the wedding or do we want to start with Chaiko-san?
Oh, we gotta start with Chaiko. I mean,
Chaiko.
like, oh my God, that like I was like I mean, I've enjoyed this entire series and like this has had lots of emotional beats throughout, but like, oh my God, when you got to Chaiko, like I was just like, oh God, oh no, like what a like heartbreaking, beautiful, like it's kind of like so wonderful and awful at the same time. Like, sorry, I'm talking to you for listeners. Like Chaiko's lover has cancer and is basically terminal and slowly dying in a hospital bed, and he's just been very quietly kind of dealing with this entire situation for like the entire book series, and then you finally learn that like, yeah, the love of his life is like dying in a hospital bed, and he's going when his lover's nephew, is that right?
Son.
Son or son. He's going when his son, like when his son isn't there, because he's feels weird about meeting the son, and like, oh, it's so tragic. It's just so tragic. But then also like they love each other so deeply. Like it's also beautiful. Like, oh man, yeah, that arc, holy crap.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that arc. So we learn Chaiko-san has been there since the beginning. He's the older gentleman who loves music and coffee and is a gentle and stalwart force in the cat clutter community. And he keeps things very close to his lovely little vest. And his lover, they've been together for 30 years, and they met when they were abroad in university, and They dated for a while, but then broke up. And Seichiro, I think, Seichiro Ogawa, yeah, Seichiro-san married someone else, despite knowing that he was gay at the time. It's just what she did. He married a what is described as a wonderful woman and had a son, but then eventually had to come clean about his truth. They divorced. He got back together with Chaiko-san, but was estranged from his son for many years. And as he has fallen ill and is now terminally sick with cancer, he's been able to reconnect with his son. And I think it's really interesting how Chaiko-san is very accepting, resigned perhaps, to the realities of his life. And he's like, I couldn't possibly come to between him and his son. That's not something for me to disrupt. I'm happy for the time I've been able to have with Seichiro-san. I'm happy for when I get to see him, but I probably won't be able to be with him when he dies. And because we're not family, because we don't have the legal right to marry. And it's a very sad situation.
Yeah, and on rereading this, there were a couple of things that are not explicitly spelled out in the story, but they at least feel true to me. So I want to know what you think of this. Like, first of all, like they met in university overseas. Like Chaiko-san, I'm pretty sure is white.
Yeah, Chaiko-san reads white to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I.
So that means he moved to Japan to be with his partner. And like they throughout the whole series they call him Chaiko-san. Like he's named after Tchaikovsky. He's always talking about Tchaikovsky. I think that's how he got that name because his partner doesn't call him Chaiko-san. He calls him Ilya. So he has another name that is not anything to do with Tchaikovsky, except possibly maybe being Russian. I'm not sure. Don't know where Ilya comes from, but and then there's a line at the end where the moment where they're sort of where they met and they like their relationship started was his partner gave him a Tchaikovsky record and he was like to talking about his partner like this was your favorite record. So I'm reading that as his obsession with Tchaikovsky. We always see him listening to Tchaikovsky. Every time we see him, he's listening to Tchaikovsky to the point where people call him Tchaikovsky. Like, that is because that is his partner's favorite music, and it has become his favorite music.
Oh, that's so
Yeah.
sweet.
And it's
Yeah.
like, we don't even find that out until the very end. Like, this whole time is this, like, this, I don't know. It feels like a big reveal that's kind of like underplayed in the story, where, like, no, this is really important. Like, this says a lot about him.
Yeah. Oh,
Yeah.
yeah.
I
The
was
love
just.
that they have is obviously very, very deep.
Yeah. And like, yeah, it's funny. We're just talking about this now, and I'm only just suddenly realizing like Chaiko and Tchaikovsky. Because like when they first introduced the character, it really threw me off because, yeah, like you don't have a TCH in Japanese. And then Ko is traditionally only a feminine ending on a name. So like usually if your name ends in Ko, it's a female name, which is why initially I was like, oh, is Chaiko trans? But then I was like, no, like that doesn't make sense. And yeah, it's like, yeah, he's European and his nickname is Tchaikovsky. Like, yeah, I don't know why I didn't put together Tchaikovsky and Chaiko until now, but
Well, I think
that's
it's
good
really
insights.
underplayed in the story. Like,
Yeah.
I don't think we're expected to necessarily figure it out
It's
until the end.
something you have to put together as a reader for sure. And like I picked it up because Tchaikovsky is such a distinctive name and Chaiko is very, very close to it. But I didn't pick up on what you said, JD, until just now, that it's like he has adopted this persona to kind of mold himself in an affectionate way to be a reflection of what his partner's favorite thing is.
I had to Google this to make sure, look it up on Wikipedia, but Tchaikovsky himself was also gay.
Oh, I did not know that.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so it's actually this so let's tie off this thread perhaps. So Ilya and Seichiro have been together for 30 years, and now Seichiro is dying, and his son doesn't know about Chaiko-san. His son doesn't really even know that he's coming. He doesn't know who he is or that he's there until the very end. And Chaiko-san gets a text that it's the end for Seichiro. Seichiro is in critical condition. But he gets a text from Seichiro's own son inviting him to the hospital to be by his side. And of course, Chaiko has a bit of a panic, uncertainty about this whole situation. He doesn't want to ruin things for Seichiro. He doesn't want to cause drama in the family. And he's doesn't know what he would be wading into by trying to go at the last minute. And it's someone's son who pushes him to go.
Literally,
Yeah,
literally
yeah.
pushes him.
Literally, yeah.
As she fulfills her role as Bodhisattva to like just nudge the world in the right direction.
Yeah.
I actually thought from our last episode, Jam, you were talking about sort of the detachment of Someone-san and re you know, like reading that section with Chaiko and Someone-san. I felt like this was a moment where Someone-san kind of breaks her rules. Like, you know, instead of just being detached, Someone-san is like, no, go see your dying partner. Yeah, like, gives him a shove, like, go and take care of this.
Yeah, and it's something that she feels a lot of trepidation and uncertainty about as well, because she takes her detachment very seriously. But she wrestles with it. You know, she has a conversation with Tasuku about it. You know, and it's like she mentions something. It's like, oh, I wonder if Chai-san is going to figure this out with Seichiro. I really wish they would talk about it. And Tasuku is the one who's like, you know, you could just talk to Chaiko about it. And she's like, I guess I could.
Yeah, and I feel like this is ultimately like kind of an arc for Someone-san too, where like, yes, it's her rule to not get involved, but like, does Someone-san really need to follow rules? Like, that's also part of her character is like, no, rules are made up. I can just do something different.
Yeah. So like there's an interesting connection here between Chaiko and Seichiro and Someone-san. So they actually discovered her or met her a long time ago in a coffee class, and they were the ones who gave her iconic name. And I thought it was really funny where it's like Someone-san signs up for this coffee class kind of randomly, and so just making conversation, Chaiko is like, "Oh, so do you like coffee?" And she's like, "Not particularly." No. Just because I take a coffee class does not mean I am a coffee liking person. Don't put that on me. That's a label. I don't want any labels. I make coffee sometimes. I don't make coffee sometimes. That's all it is. Don't think about it.
Yeah, that like little flashback was quite good though. Like, it was kind of interesting to see Someone-san at a point where she wasn't as certain about everything, you know? Like, it was interesting that in the course of this meal that she has with Chaiko and Sechiro, right? That, you know, Someone-san's like, you know, I think I'm asexual. I think I want to detach myself from the world. And like, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, like live your truth. Like you can just be Someone-san, you know? Like, yeah, I think it was kind of interesting how it was like that was almost this moment of realization for Someone-san. And that's like where the name, but also I think kind of that journey to detachment sort of almost begins there, you know?
Yeah, and there's also this thread throughout the work that I think that like Someone-san is not really as detached as she wants others to think she is, or maybe that she admits to herself as being. She's managed to like create this whole community around her, and she does actually care. She monitors things very closely. She does care about what's going on. But she does try to stay at this distance, you know. She doesn't want to be a leader. She doesn't want to be the center. She doesn't want the community to revolve around her. She mentioned something really interesting of like, I don't want to go to the wedding because I would just be a background character in this situation, which I'm not really sure what she meant by that, but it was such an
Yeah,
interesting line.
and she does end up like going to Is it just the reception that she goes to? She's there. She's
She's there.
around.
She's like outside.
Yeah.
And
So,
she's like, I'm not actually here. I'm just on my walk. And this happened to be on my
I just
walk.
happen to be hanging around outside this wedding for all these people I care about. Not
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
doesn't mean
Well, whatever.
anything.
Yeah. Just, it's just a
I'm
coincidence.
just here in my Crocs. Whatever. No big deal.
Speaking of the wedding, I feel like both the wedding and Chaiko-san's story speak to the importance of like having these kind of like official like public declarations where like the all of Chaiko-san's dilemma or a big part of it is the fact that he and his partner of 30 years aren't like anything official as far as the government is concerned. So he doesn't have the ability without the son's involvement to be there in his partner's final moments. And I mean that happens after the plan for Haruko and Saki to get married, but they do talk about that in relation to their wedding of like, no, this is why this is worth doing, because like sooner or later something like this is going to matter.
Yeah.
It's a big motivation that pushes them to do it. It's something they'd been talking about. It's something that Haruko clearly wanted, but it is this situation between Aiko-san and his partner that really underscores the need.
I think also, I mean, also the getting outed, like Saki getting outed by like Toma's dad was also like another big inciting incident, which like I will say, like I really enjoyed the like obviously in the moment when Saki gets outed without, you know, consent, that really sucks. But like she has this dinner with her parents. And there's a scene where her dad is like, you know, kind of just like, well, I'm just like a know nothing working schlub and I don't know very much, but if this girl makes you happy, like I'm okay with it, you know? And it was like this beautiful kind of like clumsy act of acceptance. And then I also just love that then after the dad is like, well, I guess I'm okay with it, the mom is like, oh good, I don't have to like rend you to ribbons, like, and she's like, so you're getting married, great, let's go. Like, I love that the mom was just like, all right, I'm gonna let my husband work through this on his own, and assuming he makes the right choice, I'm down, like we're in, this wedding's happening, let's go. Like, I loved it.
And also just such an interesting, like from a character dynamic point of view of the outing where like Toma's, when that first happened, my first reaction was like, this is Toma, he's done this. How dare he do this? He's doing this maliciously. Turns out that's not the case at all. And like Toma's dad is like very apologetic afterwards of the mistake he's made.
Oh,
But yeah, like these are like important events for these characters for
yeah.
sure.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I was gonna say, Toma's dad apologizing to Haruko and Saki was that was like the most Japanese thing in that whole comic. Like, just the apology and the bow, and just it's like, yeah, I'm like, that is so Japanese. That is like the most Japanese apology. Like, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. There's a difference between acceptance or what you feel in the abstract and what you feel when it's right in front of you. So, certainly, Saki's dad had an idea about homosexuality in the abstract. And he had already made up his mind. He thought of, like, this is something I could never accept for my daughter until it was put in his face of, like, this is your daughter who you love. And this is who she loves. Deal with it, right? You know, like, how are you going to deal with it when it's no longer abstract, it's concrete? And I thought it was really interesting that we see an immediate mirror of that situation between Homa and his dad. So Tsubaki-san is the one who accidentally outed them and comes to Cat Clutter, and he's like, wait a minute, if this is like where the queers hang out, why is my son Homa here? And he starts getting flustered and shitty about it. And then suddenly Tasuku decides to stand up and stand between them. And he's like, look, all right, you know what? I'm gay. I'm your son's friend. Deal with me. deal with it. What are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do? No longer abstract, concretely, I'm standing here and this is who I am. What are you going to do?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, it's I'd like to think that more people would, you know, if confronted with actual queer people in front of them, would just like realize like, "Oh, yeah, this is fine. I don't have to be a jerk." So much of this is in the abstract. It's like people are being shitty 'cause they just it's not a real tangible thing in front of their face. I'd like to hope that, you know, a lot of people would do the right thing, but who knows?
It's strange. Sometimes you hear about how they create exceptions. So even if they do know someone, they're like, but you're not like those other ones. And so they create a weird exception within their heads where it's
You're
like,
one of the good
yeah, I know
ones.
you, but you're not one of those gays, right? You know? And it gets back to this theme of like understanding versus acceptance, you know? And it's like, to whatever extent can be explained and internalized, you're never going to understand it at like perhaps a level that you can accept, but you are going to have to decide on acceptance. Whether or not you understand what they're asking for is acceptance, right?
And I think maybe that's I mean, I think that's kind of where things land with Tasuku and Misora is that ultimately Tasuku is just like, hey, you know, I was trying to help, but like clearly I didn't get it all. Like I just whatever. Like I just accept you like as you are. Whatever's good for you. You set the pace. I just want us to be good. And I thought like that their relationship really it was nice to see their relationship get repaired kind of at the end of the story, you know?
Yeah, that was really nice. I was really glad to see Misora back and attending the wedding and happy. It was great to see him.
All right. We're just about out of time. Anything else we want to make sure we don't miss out on talking about? There's a lot to get into with this book, obviously.
Yeah, I think we covered the major beats though, and I'm glad for that. So yeah, final thoughts, recommendations.
I mean, I'm just gonna. I actually originally was thinking I'd do help use this for our cold open, but I forgot. So I'm just gonna read you a post from Blue Sky that I read the day after I finished reading volume four, which somebody posted, "Don't mind me, just ugly crying on a Sunday night reading Our Dreams at Dusk." And I was just like, "Oh, you and me both."
Yeah, such a good book. So different from any other manga. So different from other comics generally. Like it's very unique, and like I want more people to read it because like the range of what comics can be should definitely include not just the sort of the characters and the content in this work, but like the way that it's put together, like the setup of it and the sort of the I don't know how to say it, like the art of it.
Yeah, this is a really good book. I can really see why you recommended it, Jam. I really enjoyed reading it, and I feel like I don't know, I think this has a little something for everyone. Like I feel like it has the queer experience for queer readers, but I also think that like straight people could read this and like learn something from it too. Like, yeah, it's just like a very well-rounded work that I think presents a lot of perspectives. That everyone could sort of gain something from.
Yeah, I'm glad you both enjoyed it. Thank you for powering through the challenges of getting it in your hands. But I love this work. I reread it a lot, and it's really something special, I think. And I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. I want more people to read it. I want it to continue being available. So hopefully we can turn around the availability of Volume 4.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, hopefully if anyone's listening who works at in publishing, like just fix the licensing on this Kobo, guys. Come
Yeah,
on.
Seven Seas. Seven Seas, bring us back volume four. Okay, so then we can wrap up with shout outs.
Yeah, okay, so I actually have something to shout out this time. I finally finished reading Wicked, like the book. I have not yet seen the movie or the musical. That's next on my list, I guess. It's a really weird book. But it takes place in a very weird universe. Like the Oz books are inherently strange, and this book kind of fleshes out the world a lot, and but also really leans into the weirdness. It wasn't as queer as I had been told, but it's also not queer, so if whatever that's worth.
All right. I've heard good things about the book. I've heard that the book is a very different from the musical and the movie.
That wouldn't surprise me. I have no idea how you would turn this book into a musical. I guess we'll see.
I watched the musical and I like live once and I enjoyed it, but I've heard that all the lore basically is gone. And so like if you read the book, it's really all about the lore, and then the musical just kind of takes the broad strokes and like makes a musical out of it. But I mean, they have that. I'm sure there's some, yeah, whatever. I mean, musical. It's a good musical, so like, it's still good for other reasons. Yeah. All right. I'm Jeff Ellis, and I'm gonna just shout out Canadian publishing. We're in a time where a lot of Canadians are looking to divest of American product and pick up Canadian product, and I just want everyone to know that. Like in Winnipeg, there's At Bay Press. In just outside of Calgary, there's Renegade Press. Obviously, in Montreal, there's Drawn and Quarterly. In Vancouver, we have Cloudscape Comics.
Toronto has Groundwood.
And Highwater Press is another one in Manitoba. There's like Toronto Comics based out of Toronto as well. There's probably a whole bunch of other ones I'm forgetting, but long story short, there's like some really amazing Canadian publishers. So consider buying some Canadian books. Because, yeah, we actually have a really good comic scene. And let me tell you, especially right now, every single Canadian publisher needs your support. So buy a bunch of Canadian books. It'll be awesome.
Yeah, and that dovetails well with my shout out. I am Jam. And on the topic of CanCon, I'd like to shout out Gender Failure by Ray Spoon and Ivan E. Coyote, which is a book that I finally got a chance to get around to reading. And it is published by Arsenal Pulp Press, which is a Canadian publisher. And the two authors are one is from Whitehorse and the other is from Calgary, and they now live in Vancouver and Montreal, so it doesn't get more Canadian than that. But it's a book about gender from a first person experience, and I found it really affecting and insightful. So Gender Failure is my shout out for this week.
What's our next book?
Our next book is going to be Spider-Man: Kraven's Last Hunt.
Okay, and we're gonna do another mini-sode before that, so you can expect to see that soon.
Woohoo!
All right, cool. Thank you so much for listening. The Trade Waiters is presented from Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music, and you can find us wherever you catch your pod.
Yeah, gotta catch those pods. Gotta catch them all.
No, you don't need them all. There's too many. There are more podcasts than there are Pokemon. That's excessive.